Good morning and welcome to the December 21st, 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for being here this morning. Due to COVID-19, today's meeting will be conducted virtually. Any members of the public that are encouraged to speak, and if you do wish to make comment or ask questions during the business session, please be sure to state your name or address for the record, and if you'd be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes initially, so that everyone would have an opportunity to talk. And we will be opening those lines up officially in the business session, but if anything is of interest during the meeting, please make your questions known. Today we have all five commissioners present, General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Wolquist, and Rebecca Parkin, Clerk of the Board, are in the boardroom. Before we get started, I'd like to just take a moment and thank everyone for their patience and their outstanding work during 2020. It's been a challenging year, and I certainly don't have to tell you that. And the work product that we received at the district from staff has been outstanding. I really want to extend my gratitude for all of the staff and the hard work and the effort and the challenges that they dealt with in 2020. As well, I'd like to wish everyone the happiest of holidays and a much better 2021. And with that, Tim, if you're willing to lead us, please, in the Pledge of Allegiance and an HPI moment.
That would be my honor.
Thank you.
So my name is Tim Dietering. I'm a senior project manager in the Engineering Project Management Department. So if you'll join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
America.
Republic for which it stands, one nation under God,
indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all. So thank you, everybody. And our safety measure today is one that is increasingly appropriate, and it is driving in snow and ice conditions. So the best advice for driving in bad winter weather is basically not to drive at all if you can avoid it. Or at least don't go out until after the snow plows and sanding trucks have had a chance to do their work. And always, always allow yourself extra time to reach your destination. But if you must drive in snowy conditions, make sure your car is prepared and that you know how to handle road conditions. First, check your tires for proper inflation pressures, and the PSI you should use is in your owner's manual, or it'll be located on the inside edge of the driver's door. It's highly recommended that you use all-season or winter tires, and the way you tell on that is there will be an M and S on the side of the tire for all-season tires, or a snowflake emblem if they are winter tires. And winter tires are typically the best because they have a softer rubber compound that will grip the snow better in cold temperatures. Studded tires will help in icy conditions, but are not necessary for most driving conditions and are on the roads. So some rules when driving on icy roads. First, decrease your speed and leave yourself plenty of room to stop. It's recommended that you allow at least 3 times more space than usual between you and the car in front of you. Always brake gently to avoid skidding, and if your wheels start to lock up, ease off the brake. Also, turn on your lights to increase your visibility to other motorists and keep your lights and windshield clean. Use lower gears to keep traction, especially on hills. And this can also be done in vehicles with automatic transitions, but does take some practice. Many newer vehicles also have a manual mode which can be used and minimize the need for braking when going downhill. I personally have used this many times going over the mountain passes as recently as last weekend with great success. You should never use cruise control on icy roads, and it's also recommended to limit using overdrive to keep your transmission better engaged. And I apologize for just a moment. My computer screen just locked up on me briefly. I got logged back in. There we go. Let's see. Be especially careful when driving on bridges, overpasses, or frequently traveled roads, which will freeze first. And even at temperatures above freezing, if the conditions are wet, and it's been cold, you might encounter ice in shady areas or in exposed roadways like the bridges. Don't pass snowplows or city trucks, as these drivers have very limited visibility, and you're likely to find that the road in front of them is much worse than the road behind. Don't overestimate your abilities to handle snowy or icy roads, because even four-wheel and front-wheel drive vehicles can encounter trouble on winter roads. So if your rear wheel does skid, first thing you should do is take your foot off the accelerator and steer in the direction you want your front wheels to go. And if your rear wheels are sliding left, steer left. If they're sliding right, steer right. If you have rear wheel drive and your wheels start sliding the other way as you recover, you'll want to ease the steering wheel toward that side, but gently. And you may have to do this several times before your vehicle comes completely under control. With standard brakes, pump them gently, but if you have anti-lock brakes, which most newer vehicles do, you don't want to pump the brakes, but just apply steady pressure and allow the brakes to pulse. This is normal and indicates that the anti-lock brake system is working properly. If you're in a front-wheel drive vehicle and it starts to skid, just take your foot off gas, shift into neutral, but don't try to steer immediately. So as the wheels skid sideways, they'll begin to slow and the traction will slowly return, and then you can start to steer and then put the vehicle back into drive, release the clutch, and steer and accelerate gently. And lastly, if you do get stuck, it's important that you do not spin your wheels, as this will only dig you deeper into the snow and turn it into ice under your tires. You want to turn your wheels gently, side to side, to push the snow out of the way, and then use a very light touch on the gas to ease your car out. If you have a shovel, use it to clear snow away from the wheel to the other side of the car. You can pour sand, kitty litter, gravel, or salt in the path of the wheels to help them get traction. Another option is to actually use the floor mats of your car to put under your wheels as well. You want to try rocking your vehicle gently forward and backward by shifting from reverse to drive and back and forth again. And each time, just give it a touch to try to get the vehicle going. But if all else fails, call AAA. The tow chain. So, happy winter driving, and I hope all of you have a very safe and happy Merry Christmas and a very happy New Year. And thank you.
You're on mute, Gary.
Thanks, Randy. Thank you, Tim. Very good job, and a good reminder for this time of year with the winter driving that we all face occasionally. So, thank you.
Can I add something, Gary?
Yes.
You know, I never cease to be amazed at how many safety moments we have and how I can learn something new just about every meeting. And, Tim, this one was no different. I thought, after all the years of driving in the snow, that I knew all the tricks. And you came up with some that I'd never even crossed my mind. And I just want to say thank you. We've come a long ways from... the time I learned to drive on my 46 Willys Jeep. So it's a little different technology being applied today. So thanks a lot. That was really good safety moment.
Thank you for the input. I appreciate it. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Tim. So as we move on, the next item on the agenda is the consent agenda. Any subject to transfer from the regular agenda to the regular agenda at the request of any commission member? Do I hear any such request?
Based on staff recommendation and additional input that I've seen, I'm going to recommend that we move resolutions 10 and 12 to the consent agenda. I think there's some interest in seeing the others at the commission level.
Okay. So the motion is to move items 10 and 12 to consent. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dennis. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of moving item 10 and 11, or 10 and 12 to the consent, please say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. And the ayes have it. Steve, the next item up, I believe, belongs to you, sir.
It does. Yes, we would like to celebrate our monthly awardee for the Cycle of Personal Ownership, who is Patty Wachtel. So COVID has had a lot of impacts on the district. One of the big things for us has been trying to keep track of what's happening with our own employees in particular, when we have confirmed positives, to be able to address that, dealing with the employees, dealing with supervisors, Patty has been our lead for that. So obviously a very large increase in work and very sensitive work. People are dealing with something that's a very hard time for them. Patty has done it tremendously, really been stalwart in terms of reaching out and creating information for employees and supervisors, and then being able to translate that information into data for management as well. So we want to take a moment and say thank you to her. And she is online, I can see. Patty, if you would like, we'd love to hear from you.
I just want to say thank you to all of you for recognizing safety team has been in the forefront of this pandemic throughout the 2020 year with no end in sight as of yet, unfortunately. So I do thank you for the recognition, but it goes to the entire safety team as well, because we've all been partnering and contributing and helping each other get through this. So thank you all.
Well, good job, Patty. I'd like to say thank you very much for having such a keen eye and watching out for the district's best interests. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. We have great community partners as well. Confluence Health has been integral into making all this as smooth a process as possible. So those community partnerships have been very, very critical as well.
And I might just mention real quickly that Patty is on the board at Confluence Health, and that's been very helpful to us as well to have that direct connection into Confluence. So thank you, Patty.
Thank you, and happy holidays to all of you.
Thank you. Same to you.
I would mention that we had a second awardee as well who works in payroll, and because it's a short payroll week, she felt that she didn't have the time to join us today. We're going to give her an opportunity to join us at a future meeting if she would like to do that. So with that, we are ready to turn to agenda item 4, and I'd like to take a moment just to introduce this. Probably about 2 years ago, we realized that after many years of trying to get agreement on a new coordination agreement, which was due to expire, that the likelihood was that our partners in the Mid-Columbia region did not have the same level of enthusiasm for maintaining coordination as Chelan did. And so we began to put together plans and strategies for how we would operate our projects independently from both the upstream and downstream projects from us. Today what we want to do is provide you a status report on how things went on the first year. We've been planning for a while that it would be important to keep the board informed as to operation in effect year one under these brand new systems that have been put in place, a very extensive set of systems. 2020 was really an opportunity to do live field testing on the new systems. There were certain things that we didn't feel like we could model. There's so many different ways water can show up into the Mid-Columbia region that it was we felt impossible to be able to model every scenario. So we felt that we would have to test these new systems live. And because of that, we put in place a set of mitigation tools to protect against any significant recreational, environmental, or power impacts. We did also, late in the year, receive a letter from the Hearst Landing folks, and we have invited them to participate in today's call. And I believe that there are some of them who are listening in. just so we're clear, today what we're going to do is provide a broad overview of how operations have worked under independent system operations. And then we would expect that some of the specific impacts at Hearst Landing will fall into this conversation as well. We have committed to providing a response to the folks from Hearst Landing. It actually worked out well for us to put together the bigger picture alongside the concerns and interests that had been identified from the folks from Hearst Landing. And so what will happen is we have finished the letter in response, and it will go out later today to our friends at Hearst Landing, along with an attachment to the presentation that's being provided to the board as the this board presentation is being made public for the first time today in the board meeting. So our goal today will be to give you this broad overview, and then since we do have folks on the line, we would suggest that that would, although normally we take public comment at the end of the meeting, we might provide an opportunity for those who are listening in to provide public comment should they so desire. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Janet Jaspers to make the presentation.
Thank you, Steve. That was a nice introduction. I was thinking I really don't have much left to say because it was such a great summary, but we'll go ahead with the slides. And Rebecca is in control of the slides, so slide number one, please. So, good morning, commissioners. My name is Janet Jaspers. I'm the Director of Energy Planning and Trading. And the purpose of this presentation today is just to inform you. No action is required today from you. I'm doing the presentation, but it's really a summary of the work of a real large team. So on the team, I'd just like to recognize all of the work that was done by several different departments. Ryan Roy, we had contracted project management help from Zapier. We had hours and hours help from generation and transmission, including work from systems ops, plant operations, control system engineers, Parks Department, Licensing Department, Legal, IT, as well as communications, and lots of work from staff in energy planning and training. So slide two, please. Slide two just has the agenda of what we're going to cover today, kind of look at the overview, some technical and operational challenges, how we mitigated them. How did it go this past year? Some stakeholder feedback, looking at kind of some of the mitigation measures and then kind of next steps from here. Slide three. So, and Steve kind of touched on this, but why did we undertake such a large project like this? Well, basically, we really didn't have an alternative. So, we had been members of Mid-Columbia Elderly Coordination for many, many years, and Elderly Coordination, even though Shoren was a really strong advocate for moving forward, the other entities did not want to. So with lack of Elderly Coordination, we really had to take on those functions ourselves. So Central, which is hosted at Grand Beauty, did river planning, project dispatch, and pond accounting. And so we just had to make sure we could do all of those functions, which we hadn't done in 30-plus years on our own, and just make sure that we really considered reliability, environmental, biological considerations, and also we have a lot of power purchasers that we have contractual arrangements with and to fulfill those contractual arrangements. Slide four, please. So the project overview. I think it had just an enormous amount of stakeholder engagement and outreach, both internal and external. Reach across multiple business lines. We had interest, like I said, from parks and communications and systems career, I haven't done a project that was this influential across so many different areas of the district and external stakeholders as well. We looked at some of the business and work practices that we had in place since the early 1970s. So, long history of doing things a certain way and having to take a look at how we're going to complete that work without mid-city coordination. Slide by. So, when we were taking a look at how we were going to do this on our own independently from Central, they were performing a number of different functions. And so we actually took a look at all of the vendors who did provide software solutions, who did some of those functions. And we ended up with three different vendor-supported software systems. So we had CasWest, one vendor, which supplied the Riverware, which is short-term hydraulic fan model. We had RT Vista, or Hatch RT Vista, which does more of a plant and unit dispatch. And then OATI, which was the web accounting product, which we could put in some constraints. And then we did all of our megawatt hour accounting for us and all of our participants in that software. So three large software procurements and implementations went along with this project. Slide six. So we did have, in addition to those three new software systems, our control system engineers really had to do a significant amount of work on our energy management system. And also then, one huge effort too was just data transfer. So we had the energy management system and then these three new software systems and how to get data from one to another and how they really interact and share information from one software that could be an output of one software and an input of another. So a lot of work went into transferring this data. And really, there's just millions of data points that are transferred between our group energy planning trading and the control system engineers, which have a system on the control side of the network versus our side of the network. So, lots of work there. Slide seven. So just to give you an idea of some of the statistics of the whole project, basically 2 years in kind of intense design and implementation, we did have quite a bit of planning up front before November 2017. It really kind of, the design implementation was in full force for those 2 years. 21,000 labor hours approximately. Some of the costs for those three systems, $3.2 million in non-labor costs. And just because we had all the new systems, we were providing training to staff and EPT staff and dispatch to system operators, training to plant operators. So, and then we offered training to just the interested people. So, about 200 hours of internal staff training. Also, our power purchasers are some of our customers. Very important to us to be able to sell the SLICE contracts and have good communication with them. We had about 30 hours of training to those participants. And then part of the training, we worked with the vendors, Hatch and Cat Ruston, had about 64 hours of training with the vendors to the internal groups. Slide eight. So, taking on a project like this, we did have some technical challenges. First of all, Rock Island project was never dispatched, well, I'd say almost never dispatched to meet load. It was basically running river plants, so it generated whatever came into the plant, so it was kind of a different operation. That now it would have to take a generation signal and act to meet load. Another challenge is we were just building this whole system kind of from the ground up. We have gotten some feedback from peers that they're like, wow, that's a huge undertaking. And they thought that we were a bit crazy for taking something like this on. Some of the difficulties were just because it's a dynamic river system. It was impossible to run this new system in parallel with the early coordination system. Just because, for example, if you're running the model and it decided to do something different in the first 4 seconds, maybe load Rocky Reach up a little different than Rock Island, then you're diverted or diverged from what the actual operation was, and so it could no longer be valid. So it's pretty hard to do testing when you can't run a system in parallel. And then one thing, it was just kind of the volume of data. Instead of 1 hour time steps like what we had with the Columbia hourly coordination, we went down to a 5 minute time step. So a lot more pieces of data going from the 1 hour to the 5 minutes. But we really thought that enhancement was necessary. A lot of the emerging markets, like the energy imbalance market, are 5 minute markets. And so that was really important to have tools that would prepare us for the future. By some of the operational challenges, probably one of the biggest was really reservoir elevation. And, you know, we were asking ourselves, oh, what is the average elevation going to be? Is it going to be lower? What kind of minimum elevation would we expect? How much volatility are we going to have? Are the reservoirs going to move up and down more often or not? And all of those things were really difficult to analyze from going from mid-sea formation. And then one example is one of our largest Rocky Reach Rock Island power purchasers is Puget. And in early coordination, they had shares of all five projects, wells, plus one of them in three standards, and they would send one generation request. And so then you think, oh, how would Puget send us just a Rocky Reach Rock Island generation request? Is always maybe 25% of the total or not. So there was a lot of what ifs in trying to read other people's minds on how they might send generation requests to just Rocky Reach and Rock Island versus the whole hourly coordination five project system. We asked ourselves, how will the stakeholders respond? And then lastly, really, there's no way to forecast or understand some of those impacts. And if the only way to answer some of these questions would be to operate independently. Today we're going to move on to how we mitigated some of those operational challenges. So slide 10. So we tried to be very proactive. So we instituted some operational buffers. We also had some new system operators that really focus on river operations and focus on these three new systems. We formed what we call a reservoir issue response team. We looked at some elevation constraints during what we call high use periods, so kind of in the later or second half of July to the second half of September, what could we do recreational use on the reservoirs. And then also maybe what we could do for some holiday, which is 4th of July and Labor Day constraints. So slide 11, please. So the first thing that we had implemented were what we called operational buffers. And so we were very concerned about reservoir elevations and our FERC license minimum elevation. And so the first buffer that we had put in was at Rock Island at 610 feet elevation, so which is 1 foot less or higher than the FERC license bottom, which is 609 feet. And then at Rock Beach, we had a buffer at 703.2 feet elevation, which is 0.2 feet higher than the license bottom of 703. My second type of buffer that we installed was what we kind of generally call soft landing. But once the reservoir elevation was in the bottom quarter, we implemented what we call soft landings, which is a capacity reduction that we added. So once any participant would get to that kind of bottom quarter, we could implement capacity reductions just to slow down the rate of draft in that bottom quarter. So with those buffers that we have in place, we basically removed 8% of the total usable storage or the physical storage. Along with that, you kind of carve up a part of that usable storage, the value to all of our coastal and merchant plus all of our power purchasers really is degraded also. There's a loss of flexibility. We did communicate to all of those power purchasers or participants that the buffers were temporary. We would be reevaluating them. And it's, we kind of explained, oh, we have three new systems. We have some new system operators kind of set up to watch this. And so it's kind of this help us transition into our kind of new normal. Slide 12. So, some of those meetings that we're, I was just talking about where we actually talked to all of our purchasers or statistical participants, they did give us feedback. Generally, they kind of understood that there was a need, particular some recreational constraints. They did emphasize to us that they would have experienced a loss of flexibility. And they said, oh, just because you're kind of reducing our whole usable storage, we might be unable to hit morning peaks or afternoon peaks when there's maybe a price spike in California where you can't generate as much and export or so. It's devaluing the length. We talked about some of the real-time constraints. They really wanted the constraints to be implemented on a day-ahead basis, and they said a real-time basis would be really hard for them to manage. And then they also said that, when we actually purchased this site, this wasn't represented when you did your slice auction or the negotiation. This is the amount of usable storage is really left, and so the sooner you can get those buffers out, the better. Slide 13. kind of continuing with some participant feedback here on slide 13. So I think that some of our participants have their own hydro, so they were understanding part, but they did ask if it could be a precedent for future reductions. They really emphasized how it detracts from the value that was contracted we said, oh, how much value is really lost? And they said, oh, it's really difficult to quantify. They said sometimes really that value is proprietary also because they would have to kind of give up their view of forward pricing to quantify that. And then they really kind of emphasize the concern that if we could implement any of these things on a day-ahead basis rather than real-time, that would be a lot better. And then last bullet, slide 13, they said, what other alternative measures did you consider, or are you intending to compensate for lost value to us? So just kind of wanted to reiterate that it's super difficult to evaluate how much the lost value is. The power market is evaluating, or is evolving, sorry, it's evolving. There seems like there might be more scarcity pricing. Our estimate really is that it's in the millions of dollars annually. Slide 14. So, prior to going live, we did do some analysis of how much that usable storage would be reduced. We looked at four different cases. The cases are outlined in case 1 through 4 in the table. We don't have the exact case for the operational buffer, but it is very similar to case 2. So case 1 is a full 4 feet at both Rocky Reach and Rock Island. And so you can see the amount of usable storage. And you can have a couple different units, KCFS for second of the day versus megawatt hours, but it's 3,906 megawatt hours. And you can see that in case 2, the road immediately below, 3,439. So you lose about 500 megawatt hours with those operational buffers similar to what we have put into place. It might not sound like too much, but we have a pretty small reservoir in the first place. It's considerable. Slide 15, please. So the second thing that we had done besides the operational buffers was to put together this reservoir issue response team. And so we got several people across the functional team together. Michelle Smith, Ryan Baker, Neil Rothfuss. I'm sorry for your name pronunciation, Neil, but I can never get that quite right. Scott Buren, Kirby Reinhardt, and Ellen Easterid. So whenever there's a little bit of an issue, maybe someone says, oh, we're drafting too fast at Rock Island, or why is this happening? It's put on a tracking list. The reservoir issue response team has a tracking list, and so they have priorities and how they're going to mitigate whatever issue or correct the issue. They look at some testing to fix the issue, but we do have this team together to respond to any issues that come up. Slide 16, please. So the third thing that we did was the recreational constraint. And so we had this period, which we thought, a high use period. So sometimes when I drive up to Lake Chelan, like a day like today, you might see one boat or zero boats out there, but kind of between July 15th and September 15th is really a high use period. You see a ton of boats, you see people on the shore or in the NES sandbar. So a lot of users in that high use time period. So we had made a decision to actually put some additional constraints in. They do it basis of our own merchant, so a merchant and our participants could know ahead of time that is implemented real time. Then we kind of would look at several different factors and decide whether or not we're going to implement them or not. Sometimes it's electric, grid conditions, market conditions, hydraulic capacity of the project, and likely storage to be used. So we had pretty high flows in 2020. And some weekends, it looked like the grid really needed the extra capacity and power. And so we didn't implement these extra recreational constraints in 2020, but we're going to continue to reevaluate the use of those on recreation and flow levels in the future. Slide 17. So then the last thing that we have is holiday constraints, and so focusing on the 4th of July weekend, or if it happens during the week, we seem to get extra recreational use, and then the Labor Day weekend seems to attract a lot of recreational users. So this practice of putting some extra constraints on has been in place for about 4 years total, so even during early coordination, we actually put some extra constraints on these two holidays, and our participants actually kind of expect these other entities, and a lot of them are hydro operators as well, so they understood. So next, we're going to just take a look at the Rocky Reach, Rock Island exceedance curves for the last 2 years to better explain kind of how the elevation looks this year under independent operations versus last year prior to independent operations. So slide 18. So this graph has an exceedance curve. So the blue line is 2019 operations prior to independent project cut over. And then the orange line is 2020 operations. So the two curves are surprisingly close. So if you take a look at the bottom axis, if you're not familiar with exceedance curves, this is just the percent of time that elevation is at or above the given elevation. And then across the left-hand column is just the headwater elevation in feet. And so for Rocky Reach, you can see 707 is our license max and 703 is our license min. But the first thing that kind of pops out to me is at 100% on the bottom axis, there is one dot below 703. And sometimes we have data, so this is our average data. And sometimes we get a bad data. So I think that little blue dot somewhere around 702.7 at 100% is actually a bad data because we did not actually go below our work license. So for the most part, the curves are fairly close. I think, which is what I expected. I think what kind of surprised me a little bit is kind of at the 50 percentile, you can see that the new operation has a little bit higher elevation than the old operation. So if you go to the chart where 50% would be across the bottom axis, and then you go straight up vertically, you can see that the orange line is slightly higher than the blue line, probably by about 2 or 3 tenths of a foot. And so kind of on average, or at the median, I should say, at the median, the 2020 elevation was slightly higher than the 2019 elevation. Okay, as we move to Rock Island, go to slide 19. So this is very different. You can see the blue line, which is prior to 2 dam and it's kind of what I would expect. And so under hourly coordination, we were all confined to Rock Island because it has such a reservoir. Really was what we call on coordination. So it just really operated to stay in the top probably 6 inches, and it didn't follow any load. So if someone would start up a big loader, Rock Island would just generate the same amount. Rocky Reach would have to increase in order to meet the additional load. So Rocky Reach was doing all the load following, and Rock Island was just generating to keep a flat headwater elevation. So we could easily do that because we had wells, Rocky Reach, Wanapum, and Reef that could do all of the load following. But going to a 2-dam independent operation, Rocky Reach really couldn't do all the load following, so we had to actually have Rock Island do some of the load following. And that explains why the 2020 line is over the 2019. So, one other thing I would just like to point out right here is during hourly coordination, we did get some complaints from some of the other projects, and they said sometimes Rock Island would generate opposite, it was inefficient, made the other plants operate kind of inefficient. So if maybe Rocky Reach, we wanted to generate more to avoid spill, but then Rock Island increased generation, decreased generation would force more generation to Rock Island or Rocky Reach. And so it just kind of shoved or generated and pushed out that amount of generation. So all the other plants had to respond in the opposite direction. So not the most efficient way to do things, just happened to be the way we did things prior to CDIP cutover. Slide 20 did cover kind of all of the stakeholder feedback. So we had a couple of customers actually contact the district about river fluctuation. Three of them were concerned about low water and fluctuations. One of the people who called us was asking about, could we do you know when the water is going to be low in the future because we have a surveying project. The district staff, we personally witnessed the increased use of sandbars and beaches during the periods of lower elevation, especially kind of a good example is that sandbar out in front of the mouth of the Intiat River. Some of the people who own property along here said, we had a larger beach, we really liked it. So, and then recently we got some contact from Hearst Landing residents, and they provided a letter to the district about their experience and concerns. The response team did draft a response letter. Justin Erickson, who is the managing director of district services, I think is just last week finalized and is ready to distribute that letter. Slide 21. So those buffers that we had talked about a couple of sections ago said that they were temporary, and so right now we're in process of putting a plan together to reevaluate the buffers. So the 2-dam independent team is committed to look at reevaluation, and as we had promised to all of those participants, power purchasers, based on some of the compliance criteria and operations so far, generation and transmission, which is system ops and plant ops and energy planning and trading, agree we could possibly reduce or remove the buffers. So we put together this test plan, which is a stepwise function. So every couple of weeks we test a different elevation, and we're going to capture data for each of those elevations before we go to the next elevation or the next step. Operations really are fluid and will continue to be monitored. There's really no such thing as the average year. You know, we average them all together, but each year's water flows are slightly different. It seems like something unusual happens that we haven't had yet in 2020. So even though we have 1 year under our belt, I expect some new conditions to happen in the future. And then the last bullet on slide 21, we could, removing those buffers, kind of wonder, oh, is it going to affect the elevations? And we really don't think it's going to have any negative impact on the customers or recreational users. Slide 22. So some of the key takeaways. We had just a ton of support inside the organization for this effort. Like I said, transmission, generation, park, licensing, legal, IT, communications was really helpful. We had monthly sponsored team meetings with Kirk Hudson and Greg Carrington. We had support from the senior management team, and we had monthly update meetings to the senior management team. So I'd like to just thank everyone inside the organization for all their support for this project. And we had a really robust project management framework that really helped me. Like I said, Brian Roy did a lot of project management, and we had actually hired a consultant for kind of project management. So that robust project management was super critical in keeping track of thousands of tasks and timelines and milestones and new plans if we didn't hit one of the milestones. That helped make this a success. We just had great staff with a lot of experience and expertise. And then I think one thing that shows the project was pretty successful is we've had kind of minimal response from customer owners, recreational users, and participants. Next step, slide 23. So we're going to continue to monitor the operations and any associated feedback. It's kind of a continuous improvement framework that we have set up. We really do want to get better. We already have some improvements and enhancements identified that we're going to look at. We do have multi-business unit, multi-stakeholder effort, some of those improvements and enhancements. And there always seems to be a balancing or a trade-off. There's financial impacts and loss of flexibility versus recreational use, so we're trying to find a perfect balance between the two. There's QDAM independent project phase two coming up. So with this phase one is pretty much now complete. We do have some enhancements, but phase two is to actually implement the unit commitment portion. Which with that comes a lot of efficiency gains at the unit level. And those are just real dollars. We're in the process of developing the business case to look at those efficiency gains. And with that unit commitment, we can be more responsive to operations and asset management and engineering concerns. With phase two, it does offer this offline study mode, which we can do comparisons to a what-if operation versus actual operations, which I'm really looking forward to that. That's going to be great. And then also some knowledge transfer, knowledge retention goes along with that. So, with that concludes all of the slides that I had in the presentation, and I'd like to open it up for any questions or comments.
And commissioners, before we go there, I'd just like to make a couple of quick comments. This is obviously a lot longer presentation than we normally do at the board, but you can see it was a very big project for us with lots of implications, and we're still learning as we go along. I do want to say a special thanks to Janet. She mentioned a couple of times that Ryan Roy was the primary project manager for this effort. Unfortunately, Ryan's last day with the district was on Friday. He got another opportunity. We did our best to convince him that it would be good to stay here, and we're not successful in that. And so Janet has stepped to the plate to make this presentation today, and you can tell from her presentation she obviously has a lot of knowledge about this from her long time at the district. So with that, commissioners, we turn it over to you.
Janet, this is Dennis. I have two questions on page 4. It talks about internal customers. Can you define that for me, please?
So I think sometimes we think that even the Chelan merchant, our kind of marketing arm, is an internal customer. Another example would be system operations. So sometimes they might have a need. Another example is asset management. So people like John Yale might say, oh, I have, I'm concerned about starts and stops and unit wear and tear, and can we do anything? So I think those would be three examples of internal customers.
Yeah. Okay, that helps. Secondly, Grand Coulee Dam, under the Bureau of Reclamation, can make, particularly it seems in the summer months, large decisions about withholding or sending water downstream. Under this new process, has that changed our response? Or, you know, how does Grand Coulee play into this model?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so what I think I've liked, how I like to characterize it is Grand Coulee is basically the spigot, and we're downstream, and we really don't have much control, if any. So we're kind of takers of the discharge of both Grand Coulee and Chief Joe. So in our planning, we do get some discharge average daily discharge estimates out of Chief Joe. And so that's what we use for our planning. We're asking Douglas PD, and they're currently giving us day estimates for a discharge. And then we add up all of the side streams, like the Meta-O, and the Wenatchee and the Chelan rivers, so we add those up. So we get next day's inflow forecast, but then the shape is always different day to day and very critical. So, yeah, we're trying, like I said, the time steps are smaller in the 2DM independent operation. And so we're trying to update our forecast on a more regular basis in our 2DM independent operation, but still there's all of the same uncertainty that we had in Mid-Columbia, just because the Mid-Columbia did not control the spigot on top of all of the cascading Mid-Columbia projects. We're basically a taker of what's discharged.
I'd like to add to that a couple of points. So, you know, Grand Coulee is the big storage opportunity in the Columbia. And its operation is changing. It's changed a lot in the last 10 to 15 years, particularly as there are more fish requirements coming downstream. So we're impacted by that as that the changes in flow occur. There's the potential for more change in the future. The Columbia River Treaty will change post-2024, as the flood control provisions are no longer paid for after that, and we move to a new regime called called upon, which may well change Grand Coulee's operation and therefore the flow coming downstream to us. And the third major thing that's going on is the power markets have changed. And whereas before, coordinated operations would create more value for all of the participants, that was prior to competitive markets. And now there are concerns among participants as to whether you're sharing data about when you're releasing water, which means that you're likely producing more energy, sharing data with people who previously would have been viewed as collaborators on the river, and now sometimes we are competitors in terms of selling into the markets. So you've got these big factors going on that are changing the way Grand Coulee gets operated and making it more difficult for us to understand always what the flows will be coming out of Coulee and impacting us downstream.
Both Janet and Steve, you know, that's really helpful. So our, I guess what I'm hearing in a certain way is that particularly the pool behind Rock Island being smaller requires us to, I think, be, I am probably not using the right word, but more vigilant, but certainly more nimble in responding to the fluctuations in the market and the release from Grand Coulee.
Go ahead, Janet.
I think, yeah, we have, like Steve said, we flows definitely are changing, and basically we really don't have much control over the discharge at Chief Joe. We do forecasts all the time, and we do hourly forecasts for the next 3 days. So that part, I think we're probably getting better at our forecasting. And just because our reservoirs are quite a bit smaller than wells or one of them increased, we do have to be kind of quick and nimble to changes. So we're watching Chief Joe discharge for a couple of hours out because we just know in real time that we're going to get those flows in several hours, and we're constantly watching the wells hourly in real-time discharge also, so that we can make changes rather quickly and respond to those changes. So, yeah, being nimble and quick is exactly what we end up doing.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Appreciate the whole report, and thanks for the answering the questions.
So based on everything I've heard today, looking down the road into the future, and this is for Janet or Steve, either one or both, what would be the value today of an increased foot of flexibility behind Rocky Reach Dam?
So I think that's, I don't have that crystal ball. So we have a forward price curve, which seems to change. It's probably half, close to half of what it was about 5 years ago. So the crystal ball is always changing. Other thing that really impacts the value is kind of real-time price spikes. So how often do you have scarcity pricing? And we're kind of in a capacity deficit in the West, and so we're expecting increased scarcity pricing. We had blackouts this summer in California, so we saw some real high prices. So I think the answer is, I can't remember what slide, maybe around slide 14. I said it was really difficult to value that, but our estimate is in the millions annually.
Yeah, and I would agree with what Janet is saying there. So flexibility is really important in this market, and storage is what creates flexibility on a hydro system. So if you can increase, particularly at Rocky Reach, which is our bigger reservoir, if you can increase the storage capability, I would say I would reinforce what Janet said. It's probably in the millions of dollars to us.
Thank you.
And that would be millions of dollars annually, by the way.
Right.
Janet, this is Gary, and I one of the things I did not hear in your presentation, and perhaps I missed it, was any feedback from customer owners with respect to interference with their dock on the river. Did I miss that, or just did we just not get any feedback?
So, I believe in the first landing comments and the letter that they wrote us, there was a reference to the usability of, and they have actually kind of a waterway to get into their docks, but yeah, so they did address usability of docks, but other than that, I don't think we received it. We did do, I would like to point out, we did do the team did a large effort on kind of identifying all of the public boat launches and parks and swim areas, and do a rather thorough study of at what lows and elevations are they usable or not. So we have that documented. And then one thing that we did work with was, if you're familiar with our new app called Current, if you download that Current app, there's a lot of boat launch and river elevation on the Columbia information. And so sometimes when our river planner, Scott Buen, would get a phone call or an inquiry, he would say, oh, you know, about the Current app, and he would have him download it, kind of talk him through how to use it. And then that really just put that real-time information into their hands. Be very appreciative of us developing that app.
Thank you, Janet. I guess the reason I asked that question was in this new world that we're in, where we no longer have coordinated control on the river, you know, does this cause us to pause and reflect on any future boat dock permits? And that's kind of where I was going with that. I don't know what implications this might have on future dock construction on the river. Certainly don't want to disappoint people when they build a dock. So my question in my head is it better that we just don't permit docks than we just won't disappoint people? And I'm not expecting you to answer that question. I'm just pondering that out loud.
Okay, and yeah, I really don't have a response for that, and I would have to kind of check with other departments, including licensing, to come up with a response.
Yeah, and I'm not looking for a response. I guess more than anything else, I'm just sharing my thoughts out loud that does this create a large enough potential problem going forward that we want to ponder that? I don't know.
Any other questions or comments?
If there are no other comments from the board, I would suggest it might be a good time to go to public comment. We'll just say that the specific concerns that are addressed in the Hearst Landing letter will be addressed in the response that's going out to them. Again, we wanted to be able to provide them both the big picture, which we're providing to the board today, along with the specific responses to their concerns, so they'll be getting that later today. And certainly they may want time to review that, and we are always open for public comment, so there'll be future opportunities for comment based on their thoughts about the response to their letter as well. Commissioner Arsenault, would you like us to create that opportunity at this point?
Yes, please, if you would. This is an opportunity for any of the public that's on the phone that would like to make comment. Please state your name and your address for the record, and also if you'd be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes to give others an opportunity to also talk, and then you can come back a second time after everyone else is done.
This is Cal Schaefer. Address is 4300 First Landing Road. We definitely have seen a significant impact to the river conditions in 2020 compared to the last, 20 years, if you will, of river elevations. And one of the issues that we brought up in our letter was the environmental impact of this fluctuation and consistently lower levels of water. It didn't seem to be addressed in the presentation. Is there a concern of any environmental impact from the actions that are being recognized in the river elevations from the PUD's perspective?
Commissioners, if you'd like, I'll be willing to take a shot at that.
Yes, Steve, I was hoping you'd step in there.
Okay. So our environmental staff is certainly aware of changes and has been watching impacts. Generally, the impression that they have is that the wildlife that has been impacted by the change in river operations, they are able to move, basically. They move to a different place, and that there's a very small, if any, increase in mortality. And that occurs across the board, whether it's to beavers, to fish, to birds. Specifically, the biggest issue for us and concern are certainly fish, because we have a commitment, an actual license commitment through our habitat conservation plan to protect fisheries, particularly endangered species. The endangered species primarily traverse the river in the deeper parts of the river, where there's the greatest flow. And so we don't believe there has been much, if any, significant impact to the fishery resource or actually to the other resources. And there's more about that in our letter back to the Hearst Landing folks.
Okay, great. Well, hey, I wanted to thank your group and Janet in particular for presenting this to us. This is Cal Schaefer again. I think that we have deep concerns about, this resource, as you know, and I think we're encouraged by some of the actions taken, like the response issues or the reservoir issues response team, and as well as reviewing the opportunity to increase the buffer levels, lower buffer levels of the river. So I think, that's encouraging for us. We hope that this continues, and there is a focus on improving from where we were in 2020, because 2020 definitely, we saw a significant impact that both recreational and we feel environmental as well have impacted this resource. So, again, we are encouraged by the presentation, and we're hoping that we can see some improvements in the not-too-distant future.
And if I could add one other comment, commissioners, I'd just say that, it's not our intent to send the letter and walk away. We encourage and are more than willing to continue to engage with the folks who have expressed concern to find if there are ways that we can address those issues. At the same time, you saw through the presentation the balance point that we're trying to create with respect to creating revenue and value for customers as well.
Are there any other comments that the public would like to make at this time?
All right. Well, I can just say, commissioners, again, that we have opportunities for public comment at future board meetings as well. And certainly anyone would be welcome to participate. Our next board meeting is scheduled for January 4th. And there'll be additional board meetings following that as well. So plenty of opportunities and for folks to be able to come in and chat with the commission. And we are also available at the staff level for folks who want to talk. With that, commissioners, we are done with the morning study session. And we do have the opportunity to move to the consent agenda for the business session. You may notice that unlike previous meetings, we felt there was probably a pretty good chance on this meeting just a few days before Christmas that we might get through this quickly. So we did not put a time associated with the business session in the afternoon. So we can move to the consent agenda and hopefully even the regular agenda before we break.
Thank you, Steve. So commissioners, we have before us a consent agenda. What are your wishes?
I would move approval of the consent agenda with the addition of items 10 and 12.
Second.
Yeah, it's been moved and seconded to move ahead with the consent agenda with the additions of item 10 and 12. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
For those opposed, say nay, and the ayes have it. Thank you. And so as we move on, we are at that moment in time when, Steve, if you'd like to take over the regular agenda.
Great. So we'll start with agenda item 11, a resolution ratifying field work order change orders number 1 and 2 and approving field work order change orders number 3 to contract number 19-47 with Magnum Power LLC for unit price electrical dock crews. I will just say by way of introducing them, this is an important resolution relative to our strategic objective to try to accelerate the fiber broadband expansion system in the county. With that, I am going to turn it over to Vern Chamberlain.
Hey, good morning, everybody. It's Vern Chamberlain, Project Management Department Manager. Like Steve said, this resolution is a request board ratification of field work order number 1 and 2, which total $495,000, and the approval of field work order number 3 to add $2,500,000 to bid 1947 with Magnum Power of Castle Rock, Washington. And that'll bring the total up to $3,588,853. This contract provides electrical dock line work construction on a unit price basis as required for district work. The contract is used by distribution and transmission departments to complete planned and budgeted work. And the contract term currently is through July 2022, with the option for a one-year extension after that. The district has utilized this contract significantly in the first 17 months and have committed approximately $900,000 with 18 work requests. Work has included public power benefit fiber expansion make-ready work in Manson along Totem Road and general support work for line crews. And I've got a complete list of these jobs, all 18 of them, in front of me right now, and my administrative staff has them also. Field work order number 3 is to increase the not-to-exceed contract price for future work. Depending on future planned and budgeted work, the additional field work orders may be requested during the term of this contract. Projects expected to use this contractor from distribution and generation include public power benefit fiber acceleration make-ready line work, along with customer requested services, potential storm and fire repair, and other line work supporting district crews. Also, utilization of this contract reduces exposure of district crews to COVID-19 to ensure they are available for regular customer work in Chelan County. In utilizing unit price contracts, it's important to have good cost and quality control measures in place, and we manage these at four levels. Number one, a work plan level estimate of expected volume of work over the course of the contract is used to determine volume and scope of work expected for the duration of the contract, and that's when we initiate the contract. That obviously has changed. Number two, each work request is designed and estimated by district staff and then estimated by the contractor to set cost expectations. Number three, we have district field inspectors on site while the work's being performed to ensure units and quality are met. Number four, invoices are confirmed and approved by district construction management to ensure proper billing, and commitments do not exceed the contract amount. And we've reviewed the existing these bid prices, the unit prices, and compared it against recent hard money contracts of similar work, and we believe the unit prices are competitive. Thank you for your consideration. If you have any questions. Chad may be on, you know, if anybody has questions about the public power benefit work that we tend to use this for.
Just kind of watching, don't see any of the commissioners moving forward for questions, so if we're good, we'll move on. Okay. Thank you, Vern. So we'll go to item 13. This is a resolution approving an addendum to temporary water right mitigation agreement between regional water system members and the Crown Columbia Water Resources, LLC. You may recall that this came before the board in September when Ron Slabaugh gave you a heads up that this was being developed. Ron, please take it away.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, Commissioners. Ron Slabaugh, Water and Wastewater Manager. We have in front of us a resolution approving the GM to sign an agreement with Crown Columbia, us as a member of regional, for this addendum to the past agreement that we have with Crown. Nothing material has changed since I presented this back in September. Go over just briefly what the deal is. The Crown Columbia found a client with a tenant of Port of Walla Walla that would like to utilize the entire consumptive portion of the water right that regional purchased from Pioneer Water Use Association back in 2012. They would like to utilize that through 2032. The total revenue to the regional would be $2.66 million during that period of time. In comparison, regional paid $2.5 million for that water right. We haven't been approached by Crown since 2016 because they were unable to find a tenant that wanted to use this water right, primarily because of the interruptible nature of it. But Granite came along, and honestly, for us, it's about the best deal that we could have anticipated because it's just one agreement to work through, and we will collect that revenue over the next 12 years. In addition to those dollars, Crown will also pay for all of the attorney fees that regional is serviced by our attorney, Keith Raley, to administer and put together this agreement. Questions or comments on this one?
Okay, hearing and seeing none, we will move on to Agenda 14, a resolution approving a water right purchase and sale agreement between the regional water system members and the City of Wenatchee. Again, this issue was brought before the board in September as a heads up, and it is now being brought to fruition. Ron, take it away again.
Thank you, Steve. Like the Crown agreement, this is just a final agreement. Nothing material has changed since we shared this with back in September. In summary, City acquired this water right from Lineage. Lineage is that facility just east of headquarters across the railroad tracks there. And they have this water right that they've historically used for cooling purposes. On the face of the water right, it has 780 acre feet. The City would like to sell that to regional in order to keep it local here in the valley. If $1,400 per acre foot, or $1,093,000. And over the course of the next several years, the city will undertake all the steps necessary to ultimately leading to a change application with the Department of Ecology to move that water right into the region. When that is done, the actual quantity of that water right that's available will be established. It could actually be more than 780 acre feet, or it could be less. If it's more, Regional will pay the city at $1,400 per acre foot for anything in excess of 780, and if it's less, the city will credit Regional that same amount. Essentially, that's the deal. Well, any questions or comments?
Ron, this is Steve. I should know the answer to this, but I'll ask it anyway because I don't. What causes that fluctuation in the amount of water? Is it explain that to me?
Okay, I'll do the best I can. The water right, in this case, it's a claim that was filed. It's in the amount of 780 acre feet, but there are water records up to 1,900 acre feet. There's also this issue of how much water was consumptive versus non-consumptive because it's historically been used for cooling. So all of those specific details have not been vetted out at this time, but they will be by the city of Wenatchee over the next several years. So just depending on the information they have, what they're able to demonstrate to ecology, it could be 780, it could be a little less, it could be more.
Great, thank you.
Welcome. Anything else?
Ron, I just want to say good explanations. They were very clear and concise and informative. Thank you.
You're welcome, Gary. Thanks for the feedback.
I would move approval of resolutions 11, 13, and 14.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. It is passed. So, Steve, at this time, it looks like we move on to the next item. Number 15 is manager items.
Yes, and I'd like to just do a quick preview for the board about what we might do for the rest of the morning here. I know Commissioner Bowles has an appointment he needs to get to. We have just one manager item, and then commission items. We do not have any follow-up on delegation of action items. There were none from the last meeting. So I think we may well be able to get through the rest of this agenda before noon, at which point we would finish this meeting and move to executive session for the afternoon. With that, what I would like to do is manager item. We have a new safety director, and she is online here today, Rhonda Wilkinson. I know the board is aware that she was going to be coming on board. You get to see her for the first time here today. Rhonda comes to us with a vast wealth of experience at Alcoa and Arconic. We really are pleased. Alcoa has been a leader in the industry in safety. It goes back to the days when Paul O'Neill, the future Treasury Secretary, was the head of Alcoa and was deeply committed to safety. And created a culture there that has been an impressive one for many people across various industries. And we saw that in terms of Rhonda's interview with us. We could see the depth of experience that she had. And we also saw a commitment to human performance improvement, which, of course, has become a cornerstone of our efforts, not just for safety, but across the board in terms of trying to improve our operational excellence. So we were really pleased that she wanted to come here. She also owns some property up in Manson, as I understand it, so she had cause to want to be here, which made us happy as well that she wasn't she would be coming and staying and becoming a member of the community. So, Rhonda, we would love it if you would take a moment to say hello to the board and introduce yourself.
Sure thing. Thank you very much for the introduction. As Steve had mentioned, I did my 30 years with Alcoa and Arconic, and they definitely ingrained quite the safety culture in me and as well as the organization. So I'm super excited about bringing those successes and the experiences and bringing it to the PUD. Steve touched on it too about the HP piece of it. I have been involved with human performance since about 2008 and see how much of an impact it can absolutely make on an organization when you roll it out and get the involvement from everybody from the floor up to senior management. So I am very excited about being a part of this team. I've met some pretty remarkable individuals since I've been here just for the week. I'm looking forward to seeing more individuals and meeting more people. And fortunately, I've mentioned this before, it's unfortunate about COVID. I think it makes such a big difference when you're able to meet in person and talk to individuals. But we will get through this, and hopefully next year, not too long into the year, we'll be able to get back to something closer to what we had before, hopefully. But in the meantime, we'll keep continuing to deal with the challenges that we have and keep moving forward. And again, I'm just very thankful to be a part of this team and very excited. So thank you for having me.
Rhonda, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you, Tickle Pink, and can't wait for the day when we can meet in person to say hello.
Thank you.
Yep. Look forward to that.
Absolutely.
And certainly.
I think we look forward to meeting everybody again. It's been a year.
Commissioners, I would like to take this moment to thank Tracy Yount, who really has done a fabulous job in the interim role since June, it's now been. And he has led a number of efforts, including helping us to get it to a better definition of what it would take to get to top quartile for safety, and has been our lead with respect to understanding COVID impacts and how we translate what's going on at the Center for Disease Control and other federal agencies, as well as what comes at us from the state agencies, and how we interpret that and put it in place here at the district. In fact, he has done such a good job, we have asked him to stay on in terms of leading our COVID response efforts for at least the next 5 months, because it just felt like to say to Rhonda, you've got to take on this big task of moving us to top quartile and help us with human performance, and you need to get started and hit the ground running. At the same time, you need to understand all the stuff that we've done in the last 6 months in terms of interpreting all these regulations that are coming at us and how to apply them to COVID. That just looked like an overwhelming set of duties. So Tracy has agreed to continue to take on that function, and we are pleased that he has done so. And they think they will, the combination of Tracy and Rhonda will do us really well. With that, finished with manager items, and would like to move to any commission items.
So, commissioners, we have before us a proposed motion. Would a commissioner wish to make that motion?
So, Mr. President, I would move to set a special meeting on Tuesday, February 2, 2021 at 1 p.m. to be held virtually for the purpose of holding an executive session for the purpose of evaluating the performance of a public employee pursuant to RCW 42.30.1101G Virtual meeting information will be posted on the PUD website.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. Is there a second?
I'll second the motion.
Thank you, Commissioner Congdon. So it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on this motion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. And the ayes have it. The motion passes. Are there any other commission items that might want to wish to be brought before the board at this time?
So this is Ann, Commissioner Congdon. Is this the time when we are going to look at our slate of officers or propose a slate of officers for next year for the board?
Steve, can you help me with that?
Let me just check and see. Is that for Commissioner McKenna or for me?
For Steve Wright. You and I had chatted a little bit on timing for agendas and schedules, and I can't recall where we landed on that.
Yeah, I think at one time that we weren't sure how many board members would be here for this meeting, and it turned out that we ended up with all five. But because there was an uncertainty around that, we postponed that and did not include it on this agenda until the next meeting, until January 4th. So I suppose you could deal with it, although Eric is saying you could. It was not posted on the agenda.
Yeah, so how do you want to handle it? We're prepared to...
We don't have all five at this point.
Oh, Dennis left, didn't he?
Yeah.
Okay, then we're looking like January 4th, right?
It'll be the next meeting.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. And that'll give opportunity to post it on the agenda and make public notice. Thank you. I would like to say something. I started off a little bit earlier, but I want to make this a little more pointed. And I wish to thank my fellow commissioners for the trying year that they've endured due to COVID-19. A lot of Zoom meetings have made it difficult, to say the least, and not just with our work at the district here, but also with the various associations that we're all responsible for. And it's been quite trying and quite challenging. And I think, as Commissioner Smith said earlier, I think we all long for that day when we can personally be again together in a room and see each other's face. So with that, I'd also like to wish my fellow commissioners a very Merry Christmas and a very happy and much better 2021. So we would move on at this moment in time, Steve, to item 17, follow-up on delegation of action items.
May I jump in here?
I'm sorry, Ann. I apologize.
Yeah. Yes. No, that's okay. Here, let me turn this down. Yeah, I just want to say a big thank you, and I'm sure for the board, to Gary for doing a great job of conducting meetings, for leading the board, leading the district during this really tough time. I struggle with Zoom meetings, and I would have really struggled with being president during this time. So great job, Gary. Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to everybody.
Thanks, Ann. Thank you.
You're here. Thanks, Gary.
Well, thank you. Thank you all. You guys made it easy. So with that, we'll move on to delegation items, Steve.
There were no action items from the previous board meeting for us to follow up on.
Okay. Nothing from today?
We did not capture anything. We'll just check to see if anybody, if we missed anything.
Well, hearing none. Although we've opened up for public comment earlier, I'd like to make that opportunity available once again. If there are any members of the public that would like to ask a specific question or make a comment, this is an additional moment for you to do so. Please be sure to state your name, your address for the record and be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes. Are there any public comments? Hearing none, the next item would be to move into a public or an executive session. Steve, is there anything else on the agenda that we could cover before doing that?
No, I think we have covered the agenda.
Okay, very good. So what we will do is we will adjourn for a executive session to discuss with legal counsel, agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW, to plan the strategy or position to be taken during the course of collective bargaining as authorized by RCW, and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by RCW. We will need about 45 minutes. Now, I didn't catch when Dennis thought he might be back. Should we start at 1, or should we try to start a little bit earlier?
It was my understanding that he would be back by 1.
So we'll have an extended lunch, and we'll resume our meeting back here at 1 o'clock today. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Session. It is December 21st, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned. Thank you, everyone.